You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, August 29th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good crowd to all of our listeners in Norway.
And to you too, Evan.
I have a friend that lives in Norway that listens to the show.
I have a friend in Norway, Marit.
Marit.
Hey, Marit. Yeah.
In fact, Marit was the one who helped me with my pronunciation of good evening in Norwegian.
And so it shouldn't be too horrible then.
Well, I hope not. She's the president of the Norwegian Skeptics, by the way.
So she's super cool.
She's very cool. Got to meet her at TAM. It was very nice speaking with her.
So, Evan.
Right, this day in skepticism. Well, September 2nd, 1914, and actually I found a reference that it was perhaps September 1st, 1914, but we'll stick with September 2nd. The passenger pigeon, Ectopistes migratorius, became extinct as the last surviving bird of
was killed and eaten.
Yeah, right, basically. The last surviving bird of the colorful Native American species of dove. The passenger
imagine
pigeon.
You kill the last one and you eat it and you cook it really poorly and you're like, oh, man,
it wasn't
shit.
Worth it.
And take one bite out of it. Oh, that was awful. Scrape it into the compost
pile. I wish I didn't burn it.
1914, you know, it's quite a story, actually. The passenger pigeon was hunted to extinction. These pigeons were, everywhere in most of North America. In the 1600s and 1700s, they estimated there were 3 to 5 billion of these pigeons in the United States.
Did you say million?
B billion. They believe that 1/3 of all birds in North America at its peak of the species of this pigeon were the passenger pigeon. Imagine that. 1 of every 3 birds was a passenger pigeon.
How the hell do you kill so many birds, so many of anything?
You eat them. Primary factor to their extinction emerged when pigeon meat was commercialized as a cheap food, especially among slave populations and other poor people in the 19th century. It's amazing. It went from, you know, billions of these things to none of them in a couple generations.
Yeah, it's a story that's like it's so perfect it's almost made up. It was the most populous bird in North America. I mean, you hear stories about flocks of passenger pigeons taking hours, if not days, to complete its passage, you know, over a certain point. And then it was literally hunted to extinction. It was over a period of time. You know, it was...
months at least.
The settlers started to, really rely upon them for food. And they figured out, you know, look how many of them there are. So they would just, decimate whole flocks of them.
Humans are idiots.
Yeah. And they only lay, the females lay 1 egg a year.
Oh, good.
As it turned out. So it just could not keep up with its rate of decline that way.
I'm looking at a picture here of a specimen of a passenger pigeon. It actually looks, the wings look a lot like a mourning dove. They have that same coloring and sort of speckled pattern.
I was thinking the same
but
thing.
But the breast and the neck is like this red-pink color that's really very pretty. It was a pretty bird.
Really?
Pretty bird.
You know, this relates to a news item that was sent to us this past week by listener Theron from a place called Battle Mountain, Nevada. He claims that it's our first email from anyone in Battle Mountain, Nevada, and I have no way of really knowing that for sure, but I'll take his word for it. And he tells us that a new bird species has been identified. And in the United States of all places, for the first
Hawaii.
Time in decades. Well, okay.
It counts.
Not mainland. It's not mainland, though, but yes, it's in the U.S.
This bird is called Brian's Shearwater, or Puffinus bryani, from the Hawaiian Islands. This is the first new species of bird found in the United States since 1974.
And you know where it was discovered?
Hawaii?
In a museum drawer, where it was there for like 40 years. Somebody was going through. A lot of discoveries are made in museum drawers because there's so much crap there that people just haven't sifted through. So some guy was going through identifying the birds. He couldn't identify this one. It's like, it's some kind of shearwater. Is it this one? But it didn't fit until eventually he realized it was a new one, previously unidentified species.
Cool.
So somebody grabbed that specimen decades ago or more.
That bird must be hungry.
Didn't know
right?
we had a new species.
Mislabeled it as another kind of shearwater.
Yeah, mis.
Dope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But DNA tests revealed the difference.
Well, he suspected it from morphology, but it confirmed that it was a different species. Yeah. Well, last week we talked about surviving the big quake of Aught 11 and of 2011.
Yeah.
And this week, right on the heels of the biggest earthquake to hit the East Coast in 100 years, we had one of the biggest hurricanes hit the East Coast in a century. Hurricane Irene barreled its way up the eastern seaboard.
I predict a volcano next week.
Next week. Or a tornado. Maybe we're due for some tornadoes. Tsunami?
Yeah, that's rare.
Or maybe a meteorite?
Ooh.
I'm sticking with a volcano.
This is interesting. I mean, you know, so we were ready for it. I mean, because they were obviously you could see it coming. Got the satellite images, but you know, you never know exactly where it's going to hit, how powerful it's going to be when it hits. It pretty much battered the Carolinas, but then by the time it got all the way up to New England, up to us, it was downgraded to a tropical storm. But that still did a lot of damage. Half of Connecticut is still without power. Jay and Bob are without power due to the storm.
When you say half of Connecticut, Steve, you're saying that figuratively.
No. 51% of homes are without power yesterday. They've only gotten it down to 45% today. 45% of homes are still without power.
I didn't hear it was that extensive. Wow.
The town I live in is still 87% without power.
Yeah.
I actually had a stretch where I did not take a shower for 3 days because of the circumstances.
This is new for you?
And then the storm
hit. Happens every week.
Yeah.
I know someone who went through 2 weeks no power for 2 weeks in Florida in August. So you know it was hot, no air conditioning, and that just I feel better when I hear about that because 2 or 3 days in Connecticut in August, I mean I could deal 2 weeks.
I know it's like last week. You know, we sort of laughed at ourselves for getting all uptight over a 5.8 or 9 earthquake. Nothing compared to, a serious earthquake. And this week, I mean, although this was a serious inconvenience, and there was some damage done, there's some flooding, but it's nothing compared to, obviously, like things like Katrina, which is the worst probably hurricane disaster ever in the U.S. And, like what the Gulf states and the real southern states go through on an annual basis. It's just, it's uncommon for a storm of this magnitude to reach all the way into New England, but it did.
I was surprised to see how underwhelming the storm actually looked, because from what we were hearing, it was going to be epic. But man, it did a hell of a lot of damage.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the wind really did knock down a lot of trees, that knocked down a lot of power lines. But something really, really cool happened because of this, and it won't ever happen again. I'm pretty damn sure. Because there was no power in my town, the sky was pitch black and the storm had cleared out.
Yeah.
And I saw, for the first time, a density of stars I had never seen in Connecticut before. But it was just a coincidence that I happened to be outside when the ISS flew by, the International Space Station.
Yeah.
Cool. You saw it?
It's the second time in my life I've seen it. And the first time I saw it, it was much smaller. It wasn't anywhere near as bright.
How'd you know what it was, Jay?
Because for two reasons. One, because I'm constantly looking up at night, and I have an app on my iPhone that like literally shows you where every satellite is and all the planets and which the stars are. So I know where the ISS is. I'm kind of loosely keeping track of where it is, but it's all over the place, and it's not like over you every day. You know what I mean?
You can track it online through a couple of different websites like ISSTracker.com, and there's one really good one where you can put in your location and it tells you exact
when.
To the minute when it's going to be passing and from what direction.
The app I'm using is Skyview.
Skyview
for the iPhone.
So a funny thing happened to the Novella boys at the hurricane. Our parents are just moved into a new house and are excited about the fact that the house comes with its own backup generator. And I don't mean like a little thing like that you start and goes pop pop. I mean like a propane powered, really powerful generator that could run the whole house for days. So they essentially lured us over there with the promise that there's going to be power outages everywhere. So come with you could be over here, and if the power goes out, we'll have the generator. So of course actually they were watching my kids over there anyway. So my wife and I went over there to be with the kids. And of course, you know, Sunday morning we wake up, there's no power.
Whoa.
And the generator didn't kick in. It didn't work. We spent
all
morning trying to get it going, and eventually I figured that it was just busted. I mean, there was a light on that said it's busted. Call a maintenance guy, you know. And we got in the phone queue, but there was like no hope of them actually responding to us that day. They were so overwhelmed.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess those generators must be really reliable. But even worse is my parents made no backup plans for not having power because they were counting on the generator.
So there was no extra water.
So it was worse. It was worse than having no generator because they were even more unprepared.
That's funny.
Meanwhile, I had power. I never lost my power.
Yeah.
At your house.
At my
right?
own house, yeah.
But, Steve, it was actually good because we had time to build the SGU-24 set.
We did work on the set. We did.
Ah, so there's that.
In part by, you know, artificial, you know, lanterns. Jay, speaking of the International Space Station, there's some concern about our ability now to service it.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. The Russians were sending up a Progress M-12M cargo ship, which is perched on top of one of their Soyuz rockets. It seems that the Progress was not put in the correct orbit. So what that means was that it fell and it crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Oops.
So the Progress had 3 tons of supplies for the astronauts that are on the ISS, and they were also supposed to bring back 3 of them.
Yeah.
Double oops.
Was that one supposed to, I don't think that was an unmanned, just a resupply.
Yeah,
rocket.
I don't think, but the crash stopped, you know, that grounded the fleet.
Yeah.
And so, because of that, they're not picking them up now.
So that rocket wasn't going to bring them back, but they've delayed the launch of the next rocket, which was supposed to be, which was supposed to bring back some of the astronauts.
So now 3 of the 6 astronauts are going to have to wait to return back till mid-September.
Yeah, if we're lucky. They're still not sure what caused the crash, and that's why they're delaying any further launches.
Well, the Russian Space Agency has had other problems this year, too. They had a couple other mishaps happen, mistakes and satellite launch errors and things. I mean, they fired the head of the program in December. You know, so they're having some problems, and you know, I think it really is coming down to money. So this, you know, I was telling you guys, we've talked about this a few times. Like, I'm really disappointed that they grounded the space shuttles, and it's like, where are we now? You know, we thought Russia was supposed to have it together, and you know, now we have this problem. It's kind of scary. I would be really pissed off and upset if I was one of the astronauts up there right now.
Yeah, well, they have enough supplies for a while. It's not like that. You know, they're now going to go hungry. But the next one better, you know, better work. If there's any long-term problems, and we talked a couple weeks ago about the private corporations who are working on, you know, working with NASA to be able to run resupply missions to the ISS. But we're in the gap, you know, so no shuttle, no private fleet. We're totally dependent on the Russians, and they're having major problems. What's the backup of the backup, right? So this is a potential.
Yeah, it's like the generator didn't kick on, so what's the backup, right, Steve?
Yeah. Exactly. But I guess if you're, you know, one of the private companies, this is an incentive to like really accelerate your program. You know, like we need this. They're also saying that they may have to bring the astronauts back and leave the ISS without any staff for a while, with no astronauts.
Oh boy.
Let the robots handle it all.
Yeah, well, that's the other way to go, is let the robots handle it. Exactly.
Now, I know this wasn't part of the article, but I thought we read recently, didn't get a chance to bring it up on the show, that the ISS is going to be done in 10 years or so.
Yeah, everything has a lifespan. Yeah,
that's interesting, right, Evan? Like, why wouldn't it just be up there for another 20, 30 years? Like, is there wear and tear that they can't fix? Or
yeah, oh yeah.
Does that, and the orbit...
They can't maintain the orbit, perhaps?
Can decay after a while, and...
Well, they're maintaining the orbit. I think it's that there's lots of micro-pitting and radiation damage, and, you know, things wear out. Eventually, the whole infrastructure, they won't be able to keep it going anymore. You know, it'll become too dangerous. We talked about, remember, parking one of the shuttles in the space station, and we actually got some really good feedback from people who know what they're talking about. And that was one of the things they said, that you just can't leave the shuttle up there forever. Being in space is a lot of wear and tear because of all those things, you know, micro-pitting, you know, small impacts, radiation, et cetera. And then eventually the electronics and everything will wear out. All right. Well, Bob, tell us about the Large Hadron Collider and it's spoiling the party for supersymmetry buffs.
Is it Hadron or Hadron?
Yes.
Okay. So, like Steve said, scientists have recently made a fairly interesting announcement regarding an experiment run by the LHC, or the Large H Collider.
Don't you mean the LHAC?
The LHAC, that's what I meant. Yeah.
LHAC, oh, good one. I like that. Well, it seems that they may have delivered a near-fatal blow to the concept of supersymmetry. Now, this announcement was recently made at the Lepton-Photon Science Meeting in Mumbai. How cool is that science meeting? The
Lepton-Photon.
I love it. Now, this most detailed experiment to date of its kind was run on the LHC Beauty experiment, which it's one of the four main detectors that they've got embedded in the collider ring. And so what the experiment showed, and, you know, it might sound kind of like, well, so what? But the ramifications are fairly interesting. It showed that certain particles, I think they were B mesons, decayed less often than we thought. And it also showed, among other things, that certain matter and antimatter particles decay too similarly. The difference should be greater if supersymmetric particles existed. Now, I think we've touched on supersymmetry very briefly before, but this is the theory that states that in addition to all particles that we know so well, there's also these related so-called superparticles that they're just like their partner particles, but they differ pretty much only by a half unit of spin. And spin in quantum mechanics, it's a type of angular momentum, but it's really kind of weird. Look it up if you really want some details on that, because that was really kind of hard to wrap your head around. But so these are called superpartners. These particles are called superpartners. And, you know, I always had a problem with supersymmetry, because it just seems like, oh yeah, with this theory, we're going to double all particles. Now there's twice as many as we thought. It's like, oh great, then we have enough. So I always had a bit of an issue with supersymmetry, but it's still kind of sad to see such a theory with such potential to conceivably go down in flames, which they might have done, because this was a really detailed experiment, and a lot of people think that, yeah, they really should have got a really solid hint of that these particles exist. It doesn't seem like they did. A little bit more technically, supersymmetry, each boson has a fermion partner of the same mass and quantum numbers, except for that small spin difference that I talked about. And fermions are matter particles, and bosons are force carriers. And generally, those statements apply all the time. Now, supersymmetry is important because it can potentially offer some really key information about some really puzzling aspects of particle physics, like dark matter, for example. They think that it could have shed some important information on dark matter. Higgs boson, which has been in the news for years now, especially with the LHC, the particle that could potentially be the author of all mass everywhere. Supersymmetry could have also potentially have helped with that. And also, I wasn't aware of this, that it's really, supersymmetry is really tied, it's tied in intimately with string theory itself. Because most versions of string theory, and we know there can at times be lots of different versions of string theory, but a lot of these theories include supersymmetry in it. And if they actually shoot down supersymmetry, then a lot of these string theories are going to have to be completely revised, which is really not good at all.
So what's interesting about this, Bob, is that supersymmetry, one thing that struck me is that supersymmetry, essentially what they're saying is it had a lot of explanatory power. It was able to explain dark matter, the Higgs boson, and some of these aspects of cosmology like string theories, etc. But the second component to being a legitimate science is that a good theory is that you need to have predictive power, not just explanatory power. And that is where the supersymmetry is failing. It made predictions about what we should have seen with these LHC experiments. We didn't see them. So it's failed that more important piece to the puzzle of predictions.
Yeah, and that kind of ties into a quote I wanted to mention. Dr. Joseph Lykin of Fermilab said, "It's a beautiful idea. It explains dark matter. It explains the Higgs boson. It explains some aspects of cosmology. But that doesn't mean it's right." And for me, that I really like that sentiment, because I think it shows a real key aspect of science. Because, you know, it can be so easy to succumb to a theory and defend it at all costs, right?
Well, what's that quote by T.H. Huxley? He said, "That's a beautiful, elegant theory destroyed by an ugly little fact."
Nice. Now, of course, as usual, this doesn't mean that supersymmetry is totally dead. There's other versions of the theory that have not been ruled out by this latest experimental results, but they're more complex. the simplest theories have been kind of repudiated by these latest experiments, but the more complex versions of the theory haven't been ruled out. But of course, that means that it could take potentially years for these more complex particles to be found, or conversely, that it could take years for the theory to really get that last nail in the coffin. So we might be hearing a little bit more of it, but it does not look good for supersymmetry.
Yep. Yeah, I don't, you know, the whole there are more complicated versions that are not ruled out sounds a little bit like special pleading, you know what I mean? Where
a little, yeah. Absolutely.
If you jury rig it just right, you know, then you could accommodate for all those things. Doesn't make it wrong, just this is a feel good, you know, just makes it seem a little bit less likely.
Well, what's the next
I don't
most
know.
Likely.
Going back to the drawing board, right? I mean, they don't know. They have to...
Well, really? You got to kind of start
no,
over?
No, not necessarily. I mean, yeah, some string theories might need to be revised if they really start thinking that supersymmetry is shot. But it's also a boon for things like loop quantum gravity. This is actually good times for loop quantum gravity.
Well, I'm going to invest in loop quantum gravity companies right
LQG,
now.
LQG, baby.
Because... Yeah, because string theory and loop quantum gravity, they're both trying to create this quantum, this theory of quantum gravity, but combining quantum mechanics and general relativity. And if string theory is going to have problems now because supersymmetry is a key, really is an important part of it, then loop quantum gravity is like, yeah. So I think there's going to be a lot more interest in loop quantum gravity, especially by the young guys.
I'm going to call it LQAG.
We could do better than that.
All right. Rebecca, tell us how come we're never going to detect alien signals and SETI's all a waste of time.
Oh.
Yeah, leave it to me to put a damper on everyone's spirits.
Seth is not going to like that.
Sorry. It's not my opinion. Actually, it is my opinion, but my opinion doesn't really matter. It actually comes from British physicist Stephen Wolfram and creator of
anything.
Wolfram Alpha Project, which is a lot of fun to play with.
I love him. I was kidding.
Wolfram.
You're like, I love him. Please don't hurt me.
No, he's a crazy genius. I mean, he's like super crazy smart.
Yeah, he is a genius. He was like a child prodigy, I think, as well. And unlike, I think, most child prodigies, he continued to be brilliant throughout his life, at least up until now. I didn't mean it like that.
Sure you did.
I just meant that he could get stupider in the future. I don't know. This is all turning out terribly wrong.
Okay. You might get brain damage.
thanks for anticipating that.
I'm just going to start it.
Anyway.
No, anyway. he's published a book, and I think it's all available for free online, which is kind of awesome. You can get it in hard copy as well, but if you go to wolframscience.com, you can find it in full. So that's cool. And it's called A New Kind of Science. And in it, he talks about his revolutionary ideas, which include, I guess the biggest one is the idea that our entire universe is based upon a very simple computer program that is creating complex life due to a sort of due to the data it's putting out, sort of feeding back into it, and
yeah,
then
recursive, yeah.
Yeah, that's recursive. That's the word. That's the big thing that he's talked about, and that I think a lot of people are talking about. But also, yeah, he talks about how the way that our technology has evolved has been to reduce the total amount of leaked signal. You know, that we're making them very precise. And because of that, he's guessing that extraterrestrial life would probably be similar and so would make their signals very difficult to detect. And our own signals have become difficult to detect. So he says that alien civilizations could be extraordinarily close to us, yet still not be making such a fuss, you know, not be putting out any kind of signal that would allow us to find them. So
yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea, this notion that, I mean, by compressing data, you squeeze any recurring patterns out of the data. because that any recurring pattern you can then, you know, you can encode more simply. So eventually, when you completely compress data to its most efficient form, it looks like random noise. So it wouldn't be, if we detected it, we wouldn't be able to distinguish it from a natural signal. No. That's an interesting idea. However, what we're looking for is a deliberate carrier signal, right? Yep. We're looking beacon saying this is an intelligent signal.
Yeah, like contact.
And then the data will be compressed along with it, you know, in some format. And that may be indistinguishable from background noise, but that's not what's going to get our attention, right?
Yeah, I guess that the idea, though, previously was that even if a civilization isn't putting out a specific welcome mat, the signal they're producing just in their everyday lives would at least serve as some sort of sign that they're there.
But that was always kind of a low hope anyway, because in order for a signal to reach us and be detectable, it would have to be either directed at us or so massively powerful. If it was just going out in all directions, it wouldn't be just the leakage of signals from a civilization. They would have to be putting massive amounts of energy into that signal. Or again, they would have to be sort of aiming it in our direction for whatever reason. So anyway, but yeah, so if there was a nearby star that was just leaking, you know, electromagnetic radiation that they would use for data carrying, yeah, it might be compressed to the point that we wouldn't notice that it was not a natural signal. That's a good point. But I don't think it's really ultimately relevant to SETI, because it's not what we're looking for.
Yeah, so shut up, Stephen Wolfram. You're not so
serious. Yeah. But Rebecca, I sent you this other news item. I know you read it really quickly. I sent everybody this. The scientists warn that aliens may come to destroy us. Did you guys read that?
Definitely going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't get past the title.
I mean, the line here that just cracked me up was, so this is talking about a study, but you know, I don't know what the hell this what they were studying. It really is just sort of sheer speculation. Where the author writes, a core concern is that ETI, extraterrestrial intelligence, will learn of our presence and quickly travel to Earth to eat or enslave us.
Those are the choices?
My favorite line, too. Yeah, those are the two options.
Quickly travel to Earth.
Quickly.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
And I like how... Like, the implication, I think, is that on the way, they're having an argument about which they're going to do. Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm hungry. I want slaves.
Just eat half of us and enslave the other.
No, Mordok. We had slaves last time.
Yeah, we'll enslave half of them and eat the other half.
It's like a Futurama skit.
Yes. How to cook 440 humans.
We've achieved intergalactic flight, but we must eat human flesh.
Those humans aren't sitting well.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Yep, so let me go ahead and play last week's Who's That Noisy for everyone. In case you forgot exactly what it was, here it is again.
No one has an explanation for it. The fact that it disappeared, like it was some sort of evil oasis in the middle of the night. And that was the most supernatural, strange thing that I've ever in my life experienced.
Any guesses by...
I have no idea. I only know what I've read on the forums.
Nope.
No clue.
Anyone ever heard of Marilyn Manson?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Marilyn Manson. Very cool. I mean, it wasn't much of a stretch to think that perhaps someone like that would...
What do you mean by that, like by somebody like that?
Well, celebrity.
Celebrity, yeah, because have you ever seen Bowling for Columbine?
Yeah.
Well, yes.
Marilyn Manson was in that movie. He was the only cogent person in that whole movie.
Yeah, he's actually really awesome.
He's a bright guy. Yeah. He's like a down-to-earth, rational guy.
Yeah, the whole thing with him, it's more of, you know, that was a vehicle to get him to where he wanted to go, but he is very intelligent.
That was him featured on the show Celebrity Ghost Stories, which I've actually watched a few episodes of, because it makes, in a way, shows like that make famous people seem a lot more like average, very ordinary people.
Oh, is that right?
You hear some of the stories they tell. It's like, oh, that's pareidolia. Oh, that's hypnagogia. Oh, that's, you know, you can just kind of pick it out. They have the exact same experiences.
Because they are ordinary people.
Well, I get that. But, you know, it takes the shine off a little bit. Makes them a little more approachable in a sense. Aaron from St. Louis, at least I think it's St. Louis, Aaron STL from the message boards was the first one to guess correctly. Well done, Aaron.
I think that's from Saturn's Lagrange point, actually. STL.
I guess Aaron will have to let us know. I'm sure he'll clarify that for us.
All right. What have you got for this week?
Here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy? Ooh, another person. Here we go.
Ray, if you have any type of body injury or pain that represents an energy blockage, that be helped or healed, if you would just simply kindly have a prayerful blessing, it would be appreciated.
Now, how do they think this energy is being blocked? By other energy?
Oh, by stress. Toxins. Toxins block your energy. Oh, yeah, they're huge.
Toxins is the big one. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, but when we say energy, you know, I can only think of, I'm thinking more of spiritual or...
Well, the key word there is, Jay, is that you're thinking.
What are you thinking?
It's, all right, you got me on that one, Steve. I'm just saying, yeah. Though. I mean, I don't see how energy gets blocked, you know?
Right. Well, it's like when you cut the wires, you know, or, I don't know, it's resistance in the lines.
It's a very happy, all-encompassing term. It can mean lots of different things.
It's a Faraday cage. Didn't we talk about that last week?
We did. We sure did.
Speaking of which, let's go to our first email. This one comes from John the Funky Medic from the United States.
Wait, is the Funky Medic his last name? Or is
it's John, comma, the Funky Medic.
Well, speaking of words that can mean multiple things, you know, funky's one of them.
Right. This is true. All right, well, John writes, I wanted to bring something to your attention that is probably just a pet peeve. All right, here it comes.
Oh, boy.
Tin foil, as in foil made from the metal tin, SN, atomic number 50, weight 118.710, was phased out starting in 1910 and pretty much no longer in use by the end of World War II. As I am sure you all know, having been in a kitchen at some point in your lives, it was replaced by the lighter and cheaper aluminum, AL, atomic number 13, weight 26.982. So nobody on this show was alive when tinfoil was in use, yet the rogues of my favorite science podcast say tinfoil over and over again for some reason. This bugs me because I am so used to you guys being thorough to the point of tedium up on complex science concepts or even pronunciation.
ARFID,
RFID in the same episode. For instance, you would never let anyone get away with saying dry ice was frozen carbon monoxide. You'd dogpile the rogue who said that, and it would probably be Jay, and he'd come up with some hilarious reason that he'd said it. All right, and then he goes on to say a few other things. But so, yeah, we were saying the word tinfoil when obviously we meant aluminum foil because – nobody uses actual tin foil anymore.
But that's what we call it. No one said, yeah. Someone had specifically said, you know, and of course it's made from tin, so that's why it blocks the, then we would have jumped on him. But this is a common usage, at least in America.
Here we go again, common usage.
If his peeve is a fallacy, what fallacy would that be?
The nitpicky pedantic fallacy.
This is a bonus name that logical fallacy.
Argumentum.
This is really good, Steve. So basically, there is a logical fallacy here.
Yes, a very specific one. We actually talked about it previously on the show, so you all know it.
Yeah, I don't listen to the show.
I'm sure we have, but I'm not making a connection here.
Which show now?
It is the genetic fallacy.
Aha!
Yeah, the genetic fallacy. Meaning that the fallacy is judging something by its historical use, right? In this case, the term tinfoil is appropriate because it's come into common usage to mean, you know, that product, the foil that you use to wrap food or whatever you do with it, not necessarily to refer specifically to foil made from tin. It's just like saying sunrise and sunset and saying, oh, that's wrong because the sun isn't rising, the earth is rotating. That's a genetic fallacy. But the thing is, the question that I always ask so John is correct, it is aluminum foil, and that is actually the name of the product. The term tin foil is archaic, but remains in use. It's one of the. Our language is loaded with terms like that. We still call the remote control the clicker. You know, we still use terms that refer to
the save file. Still looks like a. The save icon still looks like a disk.
Yeah, or you know, we save files in folders, and the icon looks like a manila folder. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things like that that are...
You still call things films when they don't use film at all.
I'm sure that John gets that, and I don't think he's saying we must expunge all of these from our our vocabulary. I think what he's saying, though, is, I mean, to be pedantic and to be a little bit more accurate, let's call it aluminum foil. You know, it's two more syllables.
No, I think it's more than that.
Three.
It's
three more.
Aluminum.
Close enough. Whatever.
Yeah, four.
Three or four if you say it wrong, like the English did. Yeah.
Or in Australia.
But the bottom line is, it's not that big of a deal. He wasn't being a jerk.
It was fun. It was fun.
No.
It's just, you know, but it's, yes, it was partly just to say, yes, of course we meant aluminum foil. We used the term tin foil. Because it's also a phenomenon that's very common where a brand name becomes the generic name for that type of thing.
Like
Xerox.
A Q-tip.
Q-tip, Xerox, Kleenex. I mean, no one says facial tissue. Have you ever referred to it as facial tissue ever in your life? No. Nor are you going to.
Sounds filthy.
Yeah, it's...
What's a Q-tip called? Like an absorbent
cotton, cotton swab.
It's a swab. A cotton
swab.
I dropped my cotton swab.
Right. That's how you can pick it up with your facial tissue. That's how language changes. You know, languages are, you know, living things that change with use. And there's, you know, I'm actually really fascinated by archaicism in language. Like, where did that term come from? And yeah. How long terms can remain in use long after their original meaning is completely obsolete.
Yeah, like the whole nine yards, you know, five by five, all that stuff.
Rule of thumb.
Loose cannon on deck.
Well, maybe not rule of thumb.
We do have one quick shout out. Jay, do you want to read this one?
Yeah, so this was an email we got in from a listener named Brian Stoviken. And Brian said, "Hey guys, this may be a long shot, but I'm writing to see if you give a shout out to a coworker of mine who will be leaving our research group this week to pursue graduate studies. He got me and subsequently my friends and colleagues into the SGU podcast and generally does a great job promoting skepticism and critical thinking. He's been a great person to discuss skepticism and critical thinking with, and we're going to miss him. As you may appreciate, it's hard to find people willing to engage in skeptical inquiry at a conversational level, much less people you really enjoy doing so with. As a going-away surprise, it would be awesome if maybe you could fit in a brief shout-out. Good luck to him as he departs for school. His name is Jan. Anyway, great job on the podcast. Can't wait for SGU 24. So, Jan. Yeah.
That was Jay's shout-out.
That's the shout-out.
It's cool to get emails like this. And you know, what it made me think of is it's like every social group, whether it's a workplace or family or a group of friends or whatever, it's good to have like that one skeptical person in that group to represent. It's something that everyone could do, make their little corner of the world just a little bit more critical thinking. And obviously we greatly appreciate anybody who spreads the word of the SGU and gets more people to listen. So.
Good luck, Jen. We'll miss you. Is that better?
Yeah, that was good.
Okay.
Okay, we have one real name that logical fallacy this week. I won't tell you who wrote it. This was just yet. This was this is a comment left on a blog written by ORAC. This is left on Respectful Insolence. And it was a blog post about Jeremy Scher using homeopathy for AIDS. So listen to this. I'll read the first few sentences. What I find so curious about people who represent themselves as practitioners of skepticism is really how little of it they employ and how predictable they can be in their beliefs. If you're going to be a real skeptic, then the first things you would naturally be skeptical about would be your own beliefs. But instead, what I see you doing is jumping to a conclusion made by others for you that you're just passing along as talking points, simply placing your own anecdotal theory in place of evidence. The physical in vitro, in vivo, user demand, and FDA regulatory protections. If you had a leg to stand on, you wouldn't be writing blogs about it. You and hordes of people like you would be actually doing something in court. If it's fraud, it can be proven as such in court. He's talking about homeopathy, of course. Guys, have any idea who this is?
I know who it is.
Oh, I have an idea.
This is our old friend, John Bennett.
Friend is a weird word.
It's
to
what
use.
We use the word euphemistically frequently on this podcast.
He's awesome, Steve. He's awesome. I love that guy.
He's awesomely cranky. Is what you mean?
He's a rage. He's just like nonstop rage.
He's a homeopath who's definitely tried to take on the skeptics. He made a number of YouTube videos, some of them attacking me personally.
But he is funny. I mean, come on. The guy is actually entertaining.
He's a parody of himself.
Not in the way he means to be.
He's ironic.
It doesn't matter.
He's ironic. Awesome. He's ironically funny, Jay. All right. But let's get to the sentence. So he says, if you had a lake to stand on, you wouldn't be writing blogs about it. You and the hordes of people like you would be actually doing something in court. If it's fraud, it can be proven as such in court. So what fallacy is he committing there?
That's a logical fallacy.
Actually, maybe not.
That's good.
It may not be a fallacy of logic.
Yeah.
So what's the other? It could be, if it's not a problem, if the argument's not.
It's a false. It's like a false
premise. I think he's got a major unstated premise in there. And that is that if something is unscientific or scientifically wrong, that it is necessarily illegal. So he's saying if homeopathy is a fraud, you would be able to prove it's a fraud in court. There's a false assumption there. But the fact is that in the United States, at least, and in many countries, the laws are written that have legalized homeopathy. Those laws were not based upon science. It was based upon political advocacy.
Yeah, I mean, regardless, we don't use our court system to determine what is and is not good science.
Right. So the reason why we're not fighting it in the courts is because the laws don't allow for it. Homeopathy isn't illegal, but it's still utter nonsense. It is. And it's not even necessarily even scientific fraud. It's just pseudoscience. It's bad, terrible science. And the claims are false. You know, Bennett doesn't actually address the points that were made in the blog post, doesn't address the skeptical position about homeopathy. He just takes a swipe at skeptics in general. So that's ad hominem. So the first few sentences were all ad hominem. We're not real skeptics, you know. Then he makes this argument based upon the false premise. He goes on. Let me read another sentence. He says, so really, in the face of reality, that this is a long practiced form of legal curative medicine, do you really think you have enough of an argument against it to give you license to defame the shares and others who have medical degrees? Of course not. Skepticism really is nothing more than a name people give themselves when they want to dismiss or defame something they don't want to believe.
So let's see. There was an argument from popularity, right? An argument from antiquity.
From authority.
Authority.
And then an ad hominem at the other side, right? Talking about the guy having a medical degree as if that's a guarantee of being correct. Long practiced argument from antiquity. He's trying to say that it's legal, therefore it's legitimate. So there's a false assumption in there, and then again he defames legitimate skepticism. So it makes an ad hominem logical fallacy. He's really cramming him in there. I mean, he's got the
he's batting 1,000. He's doing great. Yeah. I mean, I'd have to try really hard to create something like this that had so many fallacies.
Right. All right, well, let's move on. Let's go on with our interview. We are being joined now by Jad Abumrad. Jad, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me. Very honored to be here.
And Jad is the producer, co-host, and sound designer of the popular radio and podcast show Radiolab. Can you tell us how you got started doing Radiolab?
Well, I never actually planned to do radio. I was my entire life thought I'd be a musician, writing music for films. I kind of had that idea in my mind pretty much since I was like a little kid, and tried to do that for a little while, and it wasn't really working out too well. Couldn't seem to make a go of it. And then somewhere along the way, 5-6 years out of school, I got the random, I mean, it was truly a random idea to work in radio. I never listened to the radio. I wasn't one of those people like who had a relationship to the radio, but it seemed interesting to me because I had been writing a lot and I'd been doing music, and that kind of seemed like this two things together. So I started volunteering, started trying to figure out how to report the news for a local station. And I kind of slowly started to figure out the whole storytelling thing. I don't know, fast forward many, many years, I was working at WNYC and 9/11 happens. And for some reason, they completely changed the schedule. And as a result, there were these like big chunks of time that opened up really late at night on Sunday night on the AM station, which really no one listens to at all. I didn't know this at the time. Literally they dropped the power at night, and so no one can actually hear the radio station at all. So they were like, Hugh, there in the hall, in the blue shirt, why don't you do something on Sunday night? And I was like, sure. So they gave me basically a slot where it, I mean, and I'm not exaggerating. I think maybe five people heard it ever, as many people as are on this call. And I just sort of did that for a while, did it for about a year or so. And then about a year later, I met Robert. We met his friends and we just started, you know, having breakfast. Meanwhile, I was doing this thing on Sunday nights. Eventually, he heard it. I was like, oh, it's pretty good. So then he and I started messing around. I mean, literally no one was listening. No one cared. We would do little experiments that involved radio theater, and we would kind of like just make stuff up. And I don't know, two or three years into it, eventually people started paying attention. People in the station, and they moved it to the FM signal where there actually were people listening. And that was kind of the beginning.
Where did your science focus come from? Because I mean, your background is in music, which you can obviously hear in the podcast, but you know, most of your subject matter is science.
Well, I mean, my parents are scientists, so I've always been around it, and consequently for a long time I went in the opposite way. You know, I was like, I want to do music and humanity stuff and not do science, but I'd always kind of like been interested in it. And I don't know, something happened to me after school. I was maybe it has more to do with where science was headed rather than what I was doing, because at a certain point, I mean, I'd always been interested in thinking of large thoughts and wondering about the sort of the eternal questions. Science somehow, maybe because of neuroscience, maybe just because of a lot of things, science began to somehow become the place where those questions were addressed. I mean, I got into radio to try and do classic kind of This American Life-y sort of stories. And at a certain point, I was getting tired of that, and I wanted to do stories that somehow figured out the world. And so I would do kind of how it works kind of stories. And that became boring to me because that was just like felt very mechanical. And so I began to try and do stories that sort of like accessed larger questions, but at the same time gave you a sort of a concrete sense of how stuff worked. Inevitably, they ended up, you know, two or three scientists in every piece. So it was never a conscious decision, but it was just something like, oh, you know, I'm really interested in time. What is time? It's not particularly a science question. It's a like get up and look at your clock kind of question. Like, you know, having one of those moments in the morning where you're like, it's 7 o'clock. What the hell does that mean, really? You know?
When I first started listening to Radiolab, I did think it was a science show, and that's probably part of the reason why I downloaded it. And, of course, it came highly recommended. But after listening to 3 or 4 episodes, I started to shift my opinion of it to more of a show about – it's more about like you're telling a story. You have a subject matter. You know, you pick your story. You pick your topic. But you're fashioning a story around somebody's experience. And a lot of times it happens to be something where there's a neurological problem or a health problem or an accident or some type of, you know, something profound in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that you always bring in a tremendous human element into these stories. And I, mm-hmm. from my reading of the way that you edit, it does come from your editing more than it comes from your interview style. Would you agree with that?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Well, yeah. It's kind of everything. I mean, it's definitely the edit. The edit is like, I always think of the editing. I mean, you know, you edit to make a story make sense. So there's a kind of like explicit thing you're trying to do with the edits. But it's often like you're trying to like access the subterranean depths of a story. You know, like what is it that's really happening there to the person that you're telling the story about? And so the sound choices, the editing choices are trying to kind of get into that place that's kind of like, it's like the story is this little boat sailing on a sea and you're trying to get underneath the surface. And that's what the editing does. But I also think in the interview, you're just constantly, it's like there's a tension. There's a tension in a lot of these stories that where we tell, where it is like an experience, but the experience is pregnant with some kind of idea that is maybe about something universal to the way that humans work, you know? And so you want to somehow understand this micro story and honor it. At the same time, you want to kind of like enlarge it and whip out of it at some point to explain something and then go back in. And so the interviews that we do often are, there's a kind of like schizophrenia to it where like you're really, it's like very technical. Like I was just doing an interview yesterday about like the feedback loop of pain in the body, and you're like, okay, wait, so wait. A nerve goes from your finger, and it goes to your damn elbow, and it goes up your shoulder, and then it goes to this thing in your spine, and it hits this glial cell, and you're like, okay, now what does the glial cell do? And you're like, well, it kind of amplifies it, and you're like, well, how does it amplify it? Is it chemical? What happens to the chemicals? Do they spill out, or do they go somewhere? So half the interview is just trying to get the damn details right, and that's the part where I'm just not as a person geared for that. You know, that's not the part that comes natural to me, but it's like at the same time, you know, that's your job, that's your responsibility. You just kind of have to know it. But then the other half of the interview is just like you're trying to get a deep sense of the person you're talking to, trying for a second to truly understand what this person what they're struggling with,
right?
The mechanics of their struggle. And so it's both, really. It's a kind of tension.
It's a total tightrope that I think you're walking, and I think you guys do it extremely well. In part, I suspect, because you are storytellers first and science communicators second, which I think for the greater audience is a benefit, because what you're doing is you're spinning this tale with these aspects of science that people can get absorbed in and really appreciate in a deeper sense, in a metaphorical sense, than they would if they were to crack open a textbook. But I'm wondering if you get a lot of feedback from scientists that don't like seeing their work or the work of their colleagues represented in that sort of sense. Do you get a lot of like angry feedback like that?
No, we don't actually get that. I mean, we do and we don't. We don't get it from the people we interview. I mean, hardly ever. I can think of one case where somebody felt like we got, I mean, there have been times when we got stuff wrong. So like, you know, we said dates wrong, or we said, you know, we misstated certain facts. And but that's
should
happened.
Never.
Yeah. I feel like that happens to every journalist. I mean, it's kind of the unfortunate thing. But our subjects are generally not upset with us. In fact, they're kind of excited. And the reason that is because, you know, it's like when you're trying to do this kind of stuff and you're using all these analogies, you kind of have to go back to the person sort of midstream in the process and be like, okay, look, we're going to do this whole little song and dance. It's going to involve mice in a big, you know, Rose Bowl type thing. And there's going to be all kinds of singing and this. Are you cool with that? You know, and they'll say, yeah, I am. But you need to say this little word right here. And it's usually equivocating, where it's like, oftentimes this will happen, or, you know, the theory goes. Oh, yeah. Da-da-da-da. So you have to kind of like qualify stuff. And so you go back to the person and they kind of help you with that. And then they're kind of if we do our jobs well, they're really excited, because oftentimes, I mean, I know how this is. I grew up with scientists for parents, and they would tell me about their work for my entire life, and I never cared, you know, because it was highly technical. It was just complicated, you know. But then if you tell a story well, and it dances and it's got that movement, then they have the experience of their kids actually caring about what they do for the first time, perhaps. So they're excited. They're psyched. The people that sometimes aren't psyched, I don't really know who these people are, but if you look on our website and if you go to any show that we've done in the last year, there is like a fairly vocal contingent of, I don't know if they're scientists or if they're a kind of like science watchdog-minded science lovers or something, but they will yell at us quite a bit.
And pedants.
Yeah, and I sort of, in a way, enjoy it at this point. I'm like, okay, they're angry. That must mean we're doing something right. Maybe it means we're doing something wrong. I don't know, but there's a faction of our audience which is constantly demanding that we do more science, we do it more technically, we do it with less, you know, less.
That bothers
fun.
Me too. I mean, we're pretty. I wouldn't say that we're all hardcore science minded people here. Or maybe I'm kidding myself. I mean, to me, you know, our show is more of a conversation among family and friends about topics that interest us, and we try to be as accurate as we can. But we've had people write in and say, your show should, instead of being an hour and 20 minutes, it should be 20 minutes, and you should just get to the facts. And, you know, and
yeah, could you cut out all the jokes and humor? And no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the point?
Oh, yeah. We get that in spades. Yeah.
And that's why, like, anyone that listens to Radiolab and recommends that you guys fill it with more science, they're not getting the point of the show. And that's, you know, that's fine, but they're missing out as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and the giggling thing, like we get, I could fill a Proustian-sized volume with emails saying we should laugh less. That seems to bother people, like laughing, you know. But you know, it's fine. You know, it's like, it's, I love science. I hate science, you know, so it's like, I have the relationship to science that I have with everything, which is that you love it sometimes, you hate it other times, you know.
Well, let's. I'd like to use that as an opportunity to talk about one episode in particular that I suspect you must have heard a bit of feedback on, maybe negative feedback, because we heard a lot about it when this episode came out. A lot of our listeners wrote in to ask us what the deal was, and that is hookworms.
Hookworms, yeah.
Yeah, basically the episode was about a man who used hookworms as a way to treat certain conditions, and the feedback we got was that the audience was supremely skeptical of this. And if I understand correctly, according to an update that you guys posted on your website, the FDA was equally suspicious of this person. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your feelings about the whole hookworm story, how you felt about it, and if you feel that you guys have, you know, a responsibility to sort of triple check the science of what's happening in these stories, because it was a really fantastic story, but I think that a lot of people wondered if the science was quite right.
Right. Well, I like the story. I stand by it. I could be wrong about this. I mean, so definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that this guy was closed down because his science was shoddy necessarily. I think he was closed down because his whole business was shady, frankly. Like he hadn't gotten any clearances. He hadn't run it through any sort of the necessary approvals. But I mean, the fundamental scientific backing of do hookworms regulate the immune system and do they do the things he's claiming they do? There's a fair number of people who have studied these and done it in a controlled way, not for sale, but just for research purposes. And they think he's right. Now, whether or not he should be administering it just out of his kitchen, that's another question. And so we were profiling the guy not to advocate for his product, not at all. But we found it raises a very, very interesting hypothesis about, you know, cleanliness, about the really fascinating role that these critters could be. Like, these are tiny, tiny critters, and the fact that they might have a very sophisticated abilities to regulate our immune system, and that we may have co-evolved with them. That was all fascinating to us. I could give less of a shit whether or not he sells his hookworms. And I hope we expressed our skepticism strongly enough. I mean, if we didn't, then you know, your list, the people who are complaining may have a point. That's part of that tension that I was talking about. I mean, we're you can find something fascinating, but not necessarily agree with it. I think it's a worthy profile. At the same time, I hope it didn't come off like we were advocating for his.
It's really tricky. This is, I think, a generic problem or a challenge, I should say, with non-scientists being science journalists. And even the ones that I greatly respect, like I think you guys overall do a great job, there's ones like Carl Zimmer, who I think is just a fabulous science journalist. I think where they often get into trouble is in seeing the real full context of a story like that, putting it into its proper perspective. So, for example, my problem, I think, with the way that this guy's story was presented was, you know, his data was all very preliminary and basic science, and he was extrapolating from that way beyond, you know, the science that had been established to clinical claims. That was the problem with what he was doing. And, you know, I'm not sure that a non-physician or non, you know, a medical researcher would necessarily see that or would understand that was the nub of the problem with what he was doing. So and even a, mm-hmm. even a, if you mm-hmm. do your job really well as a journalist, you could still miss context like that. Do you worry that can sometimes happen, and how do you protect against it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you always worry. I mean, I'm not sure that maybe I didn't make my point just a second ago. He's not a researcher. We never presented him as a researcher. There were researchers in that piece who we did check their science, and we think it's interesting and we think it's solid. You know, our intent was not to say this guy has a great idea that he has the evidence. It was more like, here's a guy who's doing something a little bit strange, a little bit dangerous, a little bit interesting. Let's look into it. And as we looked into it, we thought, well, there might be something here. I'm not saying go do it, but there might be something here. So, sure. I mean, yeah, we miss context all the time, but I mean, I know the dangers of getting things wrong, and you know, it is a struggle at the end of the day between the storyteller and you and the person who wants to be as precise as possible. But there are whole parts of the process where all we do is fact check. You know, all we do is just pretend to be, you know, journalists with no sense of humor, just so we know what we don't know, or we at least have a sense of the facts. You know. And so I do feel fine about the hookworms piece. You know, if there are specific things within it, then, you know, let me know.
Well, Jad, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's really been a great interview.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jad.
Thanks, Jad.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Let's see if I can sweep you guys 2 weeks in a row. What do you think?
Not likely.
It is not likely. You are correct. Regression to the mean predicts that that's not going to happen this week, but we'll see. There is a theme this week. The theme is longevity. This is all about all news items about making you live longer.
Jay's area of expertise.
Item number one. A recent analysis shows that an introverted personality type is associated with a 25% increased risk of death from heart attack. Item number two. A new systematic review of studies shows that high levels of chocolate consumption is associated with a greater than one-third reduction in heart attacks. And item number three. A new study looking at cyclists shows that riding intensity rather than duration is favorably associated with longer life and reduced risk of heart attacks. Bob, go first.
All right. This is the one time I did, like, literally 40 seconds of research. Damn you, Irene! Okay.
That was a song, wasn't it? Damn you, Irene.
You, Irene.
Okay, come on, Irene.
Oh,
come
boy. On, Irene. Wait, you got to... Steve, you got to auto-tune that in post-prod.
George Hobbs right. Already on it.
So we got introverted people associated with an increased risk of death from heart attack. It kind of makes sense to me that the more outgoing and gregarious you are, the better it would be. But so that seems a little bit counterintuitive based on that. But let's look at the second one here. That back to chocolate here. Chocolate consumption... So, more chocolate, less heart attacks. Oh, boy. That certainly sounds nice. I wonder if it still holds, if it's chocolate and peanut butter. The third one, though, I think I've got a problem with this third one. Writing intensity rather than duration. See, my inclination here is that intensity, you know, I've always heard that that interval training is best, where, you know, you could do a couple minutes of high intensity and then low intensity for a minute and then back up. But for most people, just doing anything, even if it's, I mean, what was that recent news item? 15 minutes a day of walking would was still, you know, very beneficial for lots of people. The introverted one, number one, is also in this. All right, I'll just have to pick one here.
Yep, that's the name of the game.
Okay. Thanks for clearing that up.
Actually, the name of the game is Science or Fiction. Point of the game is that you have to pick one.
Point of the game, yes, but you'll notice that there's no mention of how much time I need to take to do that, so I'll take my sweet time.
Yeah, you'd think we would have changed that like 4 years ago.
The show is only an hour and 20 minutes, Bob.
All right, I'll go with my gut here and say that the intensity, number three, the riding intensity rather than duration is fiction.
Okay. Jay?
Okay. The analysis shows that the introverted person
is more likely 25% increased risk of death of heart attacks. Now, what does that mean? Are they sitting there like just frustrated and pissed off because they're afraid to do and say what they want? I mean, it could mean that they're leading a more stressful life, but at the same time, introverted people to me always seem to be a hell of a lot calmer than me, and I'm certainly not introverted, and I'm certainly a stress case. But then, of course, that's my anecdote. All right, so that I could see that there is a connection between health and mental attitude and all that stuff, and I could see how that's possible. The second one about the third reduction in heart attacks associated with chocolate eating. I could see that too. We know there's chemicals in chocolate that are beneficial, so I can see that that's possible. And then the last one, cyclists show that riding intensity rather than duration. So, okay, I have the same problem that Bob has. Taking it to an extreme from what Steve is saying, like if you rode incredibly intense for 2 minutes, that's supposed to be better for you than, say, riding for an extended period of time. Like, I know I can't just randomly throw in numbers here, but I'm like, okay, it's better to ride more intense for a shorter amount of time than a long term. That just doesn't make any sense. You need to exercise a certain amount of time in order to get your heart rate up, and then you need to get your heart rate up for a certain amount of time to increase your metabolism. So this one just seems wrong to me, so I'll take that one as a fake.
Okay, Evan?
The introverted personality, a 25% increased risk of death from heart attack. Ouch. That's significant, to say the least. I think that one is the one that is most surprising of these three and is, I think, therefore likely to be one that is true. So the next one about chocolate consumption, associated with a greater than one-third reduction in heart attacks. I don't know if we talked about dark chocolate on the show before. I think we have.
Dark matter.
A little dark matter, a little dark chocolate, it's the same thing. It's good for you. It's good for you. The last one about the cyclists. Jay, I think what you said was right, or at least how I understood it to be, and maybe we're both wrong. Riding intensity rather than duration. So they're looking at cyclists. So I wonder what cyclists are that. Professional cyclists or people who like cycle as a recreation, like Rebecca? You're not a professional cyclist, Rebecca, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay. You consider yourself a recreational cyclist.
Yeah, I'm an amateur level cyclist.
I think that I'm going to have to go with the cyclist one because I find the chocolate consumption one extremely appealing, and I kind of have a desire for and wanting for that to be true. So I'm going to let my inner nature kind of take over and determine that one's correct, and therefore cyclist is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Okay. I was going to go with the cyclist one as well until Bob said the thing about interval training. And because my initial thought was that intense activity would be more likely to cause heart attacks. Yeah. But interval training actually is, as Bob said, really good for your health. So now I'm more inclined to believe that one. The chocolate one, sure, like, you know, chocolate has tannins or whatever. Every other day, chocolate, coffee, and red wine are said to, you know, either cause cancer, cure cancer, or whatever. Which is also why I really don't know any of these, because I don't pay attention to these news stories at all, because they mean absolutely nothing. Like, one study means nothing. So I hate these. So thanks for nothing, Steve.
Yep.
But that leaves us with the first one, which originally I thought seemed fair enough, that introverted people would be more likely to die from a heart attack. My thought at first was, well, introverted people less likely to have partners maybe, and, you know, it's been shown that having a partner in your life helps with things like that. Like, if you have a heart attack, then they can get to you faster and save your life. But introverted personalities, it doesn't mean that they don't have partners. And, you know, after thinking about it an extra minute, I realized that introverted people, yeah, like Jay said, are actually usually pretty chill. So I think that one's the fiction.
Okay. So, all right. So you all agree that a new systematic review of studies that shows that high levels of chocolate consumption is associated with greater than one-third reduction in heart attacks is science. You all think that one is science, and that one is
sweep, sweep,
science.
Oh.
No sweep. This
no double sweep.
No double sweep. Nope.
No.
Yeah, this is a review of studies, not a one-off study, and they looked back at a number of high-quality studies and showed that there is a very robust association when you look at the highest consumers of chocolate in these studies to the lowest consumers of chocolate. There is a statistically significant association with a reduction in heart attacks. Now, this is a correlational study only, does not establish cause and effect. It might be that chocolate eating is predictive of something else that is protective of having heart attacks. Although the speculation is that chocolate contains anti-inflammatory properties, and that that actually anti-inflammatory properties strongly correlates with a reduction in heart attack risk.
Sweet.
They also mentioned antioxidants. Wow. I'm not as much impressed with that as having antioxidants in chocolate. But but either of those could be playing a role. They analyzed 7 studies involving over 100,000 patients, participants, to come up with these results. The highest levels of chocolate consumption were associated with a 37% reduction in cardiovascular disease and a 29% reduction in stroke compared with lowest levels.
Yeah, but the diabetes was off the charts.
Well, they say that they wouldn't use this systematic review of studies in order to recommend that people start consuming a lot of chocolate because it contains a lot of fat and calories. So you don't know that it's worth all the extra calories, right? Because again, these are not interventional studies; they're correlational, so it doesn't really tell you about other things. So maybe we do need to do an interventional study, and maybe we need to try to isolate the things in chocolate and then study those effects.
Yeah, cocoa bean.
All right, let's go to number 1. A recent analysis shows that an introverted personality type is associated with a 25% increased risk of death from heart attack. Rebecca, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction. Well done, Rebecca.
Whoa.
Nice.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you.
So this study actually showed that there is a significant risk of increased heart attack from people who are angry, from anger. Yeah, there's a growing awareness that psychosocial factors play a major role in triggering and modulating the progression of ischemic heart disease. And this was looking at essentially people who are angry all the time. And they had a significant increase in their risk of heart disease. That was the study I was basing it on. However, I just chose introversion. I was trying to pick something innocuous to take its place. But then since then, I combed through the literature on PubMed to make sure it was false. And actually, the introversion thing is a little complicated. Overall, there is no confirmed correlation. But I did find this one study. Again, when I looked at systematic reviews, they said it's not established. So I don't think you could say this is established. But they said there was one study that used introversion, among other things, as a marker for anxiety. And anxiety correlates with increased risk of heart attack. So that wasn't this study. This was like a 3-year-old study. And the systematic reviews basically said no. Said it was inconsistent and we can't really make any conclusions about that. Anxiety, yeah, pretty much. Type A personality, still less consistent. Depression, yes. Again, anger, yes. But it's possible that introversion is an independent risk factor for heart attack. It just wasn't a recent study and is not something that's clearly established. So. But let's go on to number 3. A new study looking at cyclists shows that riding intensity rather than duration is favorably associated with longer life. And that one is science.
Hooray for me living forever.
So this was a study done in Paris, France, conducted among cyclists, of course. Actually, it was presented in Paris. The study was done in Copenhagen. Showed that it is the relative intensity and not the duration of cycling that is the most important predictor of reduction in coronary heart disease. The study presented showed that if you looked at the with the greatest intensity, they survived 5.3 years longer than cyclists with an average intensity who survived 2.9 years longer than those with the lower intensity. So yeah, the men who, the cyclists who survived, the similar numbers but less intense for the women. But the cyclists who had the greater intensity of riding survived longer than those with longer duration but lower intensity. There you go. But it is one study.
Even though I won, I still have to say that these studies are, they're not useless to the field, but I feel like they are useless to the general public because the general public tries to then adjust their behavior accordingly. And then the next study comes out and says, well, actually.
Yeah, it's always more complicated, especially when you look at any of this epidemiological shit. Absolutely. That's why I was like, don't run out and start shoving your face with chocolate. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to do that anyway.
Yeah, well, you might want to do that for other reasons. And yeah, they're right. The bulk of the research shows that interval training is that's the consensus at this point in terms of what you should be doing. And wow. And yes, there's a lot to be said for duration of exercising as well. But among cyclists, this is what this data showed. The other thing is this was all comparing cyclists to other cyclists. It may not be relevant to the average population, to the general
population.
Which
is true. Maybe cyclists live 10 years less than the general public.
Thanks, Steve.
So you'd say a new study looking at cyclists. What was unclear about that, Jay? These are cyclists.
The audience and myself know what you pulled here today.
Okay. They're not stupid, you know.
Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I have a quote. This quote was sent in from a listener named Andrew Gould from Canberra. And the quote is, "The difference between faith and insanity is that faith is the ability to hold firmly to a conclusion that is incompatible with the evidence, whereas insanity is the ability to hold firmly to a conclusion that is incompatible with the evidence." See what I did there?
Yeah, man? Yeah. That's clever.
Yeah, I think I get that. I think I get that, yeah.
It's clever.
That was a good quote by William Harwood.
So, SGU24 coming up. We already have a number of people who have very generously sponsored 1 hour of the show. You can do the same thing. You could donate to the SGU or to the show, or you could actually sponsor an hour of our 24-hour show by going to theskepticsguide.org, clicking on the big SGU24, and that will take you to the SGU24 page, which will have that we will have the event actually streaming there. We will have more information as time goes on. And you can donate to the effort, including sponsoring an hour. So please consider doing so. We already have 9 hours, have already been snapped up, and they're going fast.
Yep.
Yep, and we will read your name and even a message from you during the hour that you sponsor.
And if you don't supply us with a message, we'll make up
one. That's right. We'll be happy to supply one ourselves. Absolutely.
John from Washington said, blah.
We have some cool things for the show, though. We have a lot of audience interaction plans. And simple things like if you're watching the show, and I'll give you a quick teaser here. We're going to come up with a list of things that if somebody breaks, like for example, if somebody falls asleep, an audience member can catch it where maybe one of us in the studio won't catch it, right? So you could Twitter us. We'll read it. We'll have someone monitoring the Twitter.
Or you could tweet us.
And then or you could tweet us.
Yeah.
What did I say? You could Twitter us?
Yeah.
That's totally different. That's a completely different activity.
Actually, if you want, send in a video of you Twittering someone and we'll analyze it.
We need to conjugate the verb Twitter.
Twitter.
So let's say that you find or notice something that somebody did on the list of things that they can't
do. Your Twitter page.
Then we have a consequence, which is very fun. And I want to reveal what the consequence is or series of consequences. But it's a game that we're going to play, you see, and you can get involved here any way you like.
And we have an excellent lineup of special guests who will be joining us, including Adam Savage will be joining us.
Awesome.
The Mythbuster himself.
Yeah.
As well as an all-star lineup of skeptics from around the globe. Very excited.
Very cool.
So tune in September 23rd and 24th, starting at 8 p.m. on September 23rd, Eastern Time. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
I'll see you all at DragonCon.
Yes, we will see you at DragonCon.
Yay.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org.
You can also check out our other podcasts, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.